You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, this is Jen Graves. You're listening to Invisible, the Stranger's Conversation with People in Art. I'm at Seattle Art Museum, and I'm talking to Michael Darling. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
We are going to talk about Michael's 4 years here at Seattle Art Museum before you leave July 1st. Before this meeting, I threw a question out to Facebook, which, you know, apparently how things work now. And I said, I'm going to meet with Michael Darling, and is there anything that you guys want me to ask him? And one response I got was actually from Robin Hill, the curator of the Fry Art Museum, and she said she would like me to ask, what is the thing, the accomplishment that you're most proud of? The thing you're most proud of, I guess. So I want to start there.
Well, one thing that it seems to me we've been able to accomplish here during this time is to really hopefully kind of win back the artist community and make Sam more relevant to the practicing working artists of Seattle. I feel like we've got a really good dialogue going with that constituency, and I mean, part of it is also Marissa being willing to get out there and go to studio visits, and like to go out there and do studio visits in the way that we've brought them in through educational projects, the way that we purchased works by artists working in Seattle, showing them the Sam Nex project, and even, you know, shows like Kurt, kind of making sure that there's a Seattle artist presence in the show. I think there's and Betty Bowen has kind of really been reinvigorated and on a roll during this process, and we've really kind of owned that in a way that hasn't been the case in a long time either. So I would say that's probably the thing that I'm most proud of and hope that the museum would be able to kind of continue to build on. It's just that trust between the museum and the artist community.
Do you, you know, one of the things that people don't notice very much is acquisitions, mm-hmm. and meaning the works of art that you help to steward into the collection while you're here. Mm-hmm. What are some of the acquisitions that you've brought in that you think are kind of highlights?
Well, in terms of Seattle artists, or just sort of in general, yeah.
I mean, include them, of course, if you feel that they're highlights.
I mean, with Seattle artists, it's been fun that we've brought in pieces by Oscar Tuazon and Eli Hansen and Whiting Tennis, Gretchen Bennett, Dan Webb, Roy McMakin, Jeffrey Mitchell. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones too recently. Chris Brew, kind of early on, was a piece that we brought in by him. In all those cases, really trying to show or kind of use the bully pulpit in a way of the acquisition process to sort of say, these are artists that we think are doing great work and are kind of pushing their field in a way, and so we want to reward them, bring them into the collection and kind of show them alongside other artists that are, you know, working at the top of the game.
And the way I heard, just to interrupt really quickly before you move on to non-Seattle artists, I heard there was something from Eli Hansen's recent show at Lorimer Project that was being considered for the collection?
That's being presented to the acquisition committee later this month.
And that's one of the sculptures, right?
It's a tabletop sculpture.
Sort of chemistry set piece.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Sorry. If you look at it in its most innocent form.
Exactly. okay, so carry on.
Those are things. I mean, the other aspect that I've tried, or sort of philosophy that I've tried to use with all acquisitions, is trying to figure out what is already in the collection, how new pieces by younger artists, newer artists, can activate some of those strands, of history that are already in the collection. So bought a major piece by Simon Starling that's called Bird in Space, that directly relates to the Brancusi sculpture that the Shirleys are giving us, but also relates to people like Richard Serra and others, and so it complicates that.
Can you quickly
describe
it?
It's, I don't know if you can quickly describe this piece.
Yeah, I know, I was trying to do this in a class.
It's a gigantic slab of Romanian steel that sits on two rubber air pillows that are filled up with a kind of a helium tank that sits nearby. So this slab of steel literally levitates off the ground, but only with the help of these things that are used, I guess, to extract people from fallen buildings or crashed cars and things like that. And then there's a whole complicated backstory to it about this particular Romanian steel and how it was brought in during some kind of George Bush era tariff, steel tariff, and how that relates to the Brancusi coming in and being deemed as metal and not as art, and that whole, so, and which this piece that the Shirleys are giving us is that very piece. So it just seemed like this was the crucial museum to own that piece by Simon Starling, who anyway I think is a really incredible artist. So.
You're going to the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, did I cut you off in terms of acquisitions you want to list?
Well, I mean, there's other ones, but yeah. I mean, we can be flexible here. Bounce from one thing to the next.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, so Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago, and I know that you'll be hesitant to say this is what Seattle's like and this is what Chicago is like, but mm-hmm. what do you think you know about the way the two cities compare?
The thing that I find very familiar about Chicago is the sense of philanthropy and kind of civic commitment that seems to really be very present here in Seattle. I mean, the sort of trustees that are involved with that museum and collect at a high level are also very supportive of the museum in a monetary way and want that museum. Somebody's definitely trying
Somebody
to
really
catch
wants
me
to.
Here. Definitely want the museum to succeed, you know, so... that's something that I think seems to be very present in both of them. And in general, there's, a tradition of philanthropy here in Seattle that you could say also really exists in Chicago. I mean, there's just this longstanding, requirement almost that if you're a civic leader, a civic-minded person, that also involves sort of helping to keep the institutions in that city alive and thriving and everything. So that's one of the real similarities, I'd say.
How about the art?
Well, I think they've got a bit of a leg up there just in terms of the size of the population. So there are more artists, but also the School of the Art Institute mm-hmm. of Chicago has really been doing a good job lately, I think, especially in even just very, very recent years. They seem to be cranking out even more good artists. And so that just it's just one of those really important factors, I think, in any art scene, that you have a good art school, at least one, if not more, that are bringing new blood in, and hopefully those artists are staying and artists are teaching and doing all of that, and so they seem to have that figured out pretty well right mm-hmm. now, I'd say.
It's kind of an open secret that Seattle does not have that figured out pretty well.
Yes.
What do you think Seattle could do to start to work on that situation?
Seattle just needs to revolutionize its MFA program at the UW. Mm-hmm. I regretted not being able to go down to the Vancouver problem panel because I'd heard that actually didn't get addressed in a direct way down there, and I think it's the number one thing holding back the Seattle art scene, actually. And, something I was just starting to kind of have some conversations about over there at the UW. And
yeah, how do you get involved in something like that as a curator? How can you, obviously there are institutional borders, how do you approach them?
Well, I mean, almost just as a concerned citizen.
Right.
I think it just seems like this is a city that where there are so many, many other aspects of contemporary art that are being dealt with in a really positive way, from collecting to institutions that are here to galleries that are here, critics like yourself, there's writing that's actively taking place here, and yet I think there's a level of rigor that's maybe missing at that MFA level that I think is sort of holding us back. And
what do you mean by rigor? Can you just be a little
well
bit,
I mean I find that a lot of talking to students that have come out of that program, that there are definitely like blind spots in their education.
I mean, in terms
education.
Of what they know about.
But yeah, things that they know about. And this, I find this at the BFA level too.
But Cornish, do you have any thoughts on?
No, I haven't had quite as much experience.
Is that in itself a statement about?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think as a curator, I tend to stay away from undergrads, because that there's some big leap that's going to happen when artists go to graduate school anyway, and so it's maybe not fair to of course give them direction and stuff like that, but so I maybe don't pay quite as much attention to that, but I think it's you know, this is where I'm going to probably get into some real trouble, but, you know, if you look at the faculty at the University of Washington, there are not a lot of people in that faculty that have a national reputation. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have it in certain pockets within certain disciplines, especially, I'd say, within the ceramics department. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's, you know, these aren't people that are showing in big galleries in New York or in LA or London or wherever that are leading the discussion. And that's what students respond to. That's why students flock to UCLA. That's why students flock to Yale. That's why students flock to, nowadays, USC is a big draw. Mm-hmm. And USC is an interesting case because they also offer free tuition for their MFA students, which has made it the most desirable MFA program in Los Angeles, actually. Which I think is well, I mean, of course, the UW's got a lot of financial issues, but I think that's well within the possibilities. And if that department had free tuition for MFAs and started to really bring in some hotshot professors that have name recognition, I think the city would take off like nobody's business when it comes to contemporary art.
Hmm.
So
you heard it here.
Yeah.
Wow, thank you. You were in LA before this, and, you know, speaking of LA, we haven't talked much at all here about what were the most difficult parts of working in Seattle as in your position.
I don't know if there were so many difficulties in a way. I mean, it was a different museum culture. I mean, I embraced and I kind of wanted to sort of try.
Because you're at MoCA, and this
yeah,
is
all
a
contemporary
general.
Versus a general museum. So I really wanted to come to a museum like this and see how it works to program contemporary art in a general museum. And I still think it's really an exciting way to go. And I think that this museum is doing it in a good way. And I think contemporary art is a real active driver of the discussion here. I think primarily because the audience also craves it, I think. And so there's, when you do something, you get a response back and you generate more interest. So I think it's really starting to lead that discussion. And all of our curators in the other disciplines have an interest. So, you know, Pam McCluskey in African art has an interest in contemporary African artists. Yeah. Josh Yu in Chinese has an interest in contemporary Chinese. So it really becomes this hub around which all these other curators and other disciplines really start to dialogue. Mm-hmm. And breaks down all those barriers, I think, in a really positive way. So, so that in itself was different, and so there's a different pace to that and everything. But I mean, in reality, the kind of responsibilities that I've had here have just been so much greater than when I was further down the pecking order at MoCA. So the opportunities and the responsibility far outweigh any kind of niggling kind of limitations that I might have found here, which I can't really even think of what those might be. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of really shaping the program for contemporary art, shaping the acquisitions, working with donors to try to marshal their collection towards SAM or help them build their collections in different ways, you know, working with the community, all of those kinds of things. I've been able to just, like, do all of that stuff, whereas at MoCA I was sort of shielded from some of those things just by virtue of seniority and things like that. So there's no way that the MCA would have in Chicago would have called me if it hadn't been for these kinds of skills, I guess you could say, that I've been able to build up here doing all those different activities.
Right. So. What do you have essentially two monuments to what you've made in Seattle, and there's a lot of other stuff too, but the two monuments being Target Practice, mm-hmm. and Kurt. Mm-hmm. So Target Practice, the exploration of post-war painting and kind of destruction of painting, the tearing down of painting, and that happened last year. And then Kurt, which is up now, the multivalent response of many types of artists from many different places to the life and work and death of Kurt Cobain. Those are really interesting subject matters, and they have, as you said, brought a lot of response. Do you feel like, let's talk about Target Practice first. What are some of the lessons you learned from making that show, and what were some of the most meaningful responses?
I'd say the most meaningful responses, which are also the things that I think I learned from a lot, is just seeing what appear to be absolutely average museum goers, you know, walking through and looking at things intently and not just maybe rolling their eyes at some kind of weird prank that some contemporary artist is making, but really kind of dealing with it, sometimes laughing, but looking intently and spending time in that show. And which was something that I think was a worry here at the museum, is that, oh God, this, you know, this is kind of wild stuff, and is, you know, this is not like anything we've done before. Is this going to be sort of too? I mean, you could also say it could be, possibly be a very scholarly kind of topic, and maybe too academic in a way. But there was something so visceral,
wacky and arcane.
Yeah, and there's something so visceral about yeah. the objects, which is I was really trying to do, like pick. I mean. For lack of a better word, pick really obvious things that communicated that this painting is being torn or burned or erased or whatever it might be, so that people understand that. And then to use the artist's own words as much as possible to build this empathy for why they were doing it and why they were doing it at that particular time. Like if you read those Fontana quotes about, you know, paint, you can't paint after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, you understand, okay, World War II is bracketing this activity, and trying to, you know, give people enough material and backup information to understand what's going on there. So, which I think made all the difference in turning that from a very academic topic to something that was really alive. And so that really proved to me how important I think it is for contemporary, for museums that are showing contemporary art, to give people information to work with, and they could, you know, use it or not, but it's got to be there, and it's got to be accessible, and because that's that was a diff. I mean, the artworks in that show are difficult artworks in a lot of ways, and yet I think it was presented in a way that was very approachable. So that's a lesson that I think I'd like to bring to a lot of my projects in the future.
How about Kurt? That was a risk. That's a gamble.
Yeah. Well, I think it's worth noting that both of those shows are absolutely rooted in kind of local phenomena. I mean, the Target Practice show really came about because of this great post-war painting collection that we have here at SAM, and that's also, you know, out in the community, that's on its way to SAM, but which tended to be fairly American in its orientation. So that show was a way to kind of look at that tradition, pull back, see it in a broader, more international context, and then also understand what happened after Pollock. That was the next radical step in a way. And so it just naturally appends to that whole history that we all know very well by living here and having these kinds of objects around us. And so Kurt, I think, was a similar kind of thing, to try to address this history that's here and show, again, why there are international legs to this very local story.
Did you have the idea for Kurt before you got here?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I think that's something that came about as I was here, and just, you know, again, looking for things that, you know, that have real ties to the community and to the region and to the audience.
Were you nervous about it? I mean, the number one word I've heard from people is cringe, that they were afraid to see it, right? Like, that's not necessarily what they say afterward, right? When they see it, they have lots of different responses. But, like, nervous that it's gonna make them cringe. You
yeah.
know? Like,
I mean, I heard that from people, like, wow, you're really going to have to do this one the right way, because if you don't, it's going to be a disaster or whatever. So that, I suppose, made me nervous a little bit. But I the thing that just gave me absolute kind of conviction is that I'm dealing with, like, real artists that are all out there practicing, you know, 24/7, and this is what they do. And so I wasn't just showing sort of schlock or kitsch or you know, ephemera or nostalgic stuff. I mean, this is real art that's been plucked out of, you know, the living, breathing, working art world. And so I had good art to fall back on with the show. And then it was just a matter of kind of arranging it and selecting things that started to tell a multidimensional story rather than just only portraits, straightforward portraits true. Of Kurt or something like that.
Is the rumor true that you have a stash of fan art?
No, not really. I mean, things were, you know, trickled in here and there, and lots of unsolicited material, but definitely not a stack. And
where,
I mean,
is it?
Well, on the back of my wall here, in my window, there's sort of like a stained glass Saint Kurt piece that somebody passed along.
Wow.
But,
they sent that unsolicited.
Yeah.
Wow. So, sitting on a lotus.
There's a.
There might wearing be a Buddhist, or holding a Buddhist arm.
A few things like that, but and of course, you know, once the word got out about the show, you know, things were starting to come in, and.
What do you do with the things? Well, send them back to you. What do you do?
I mean, I'm not getting like physical artworks being sent to me for the most part, but it's usually kind of documentation of this or that. And so.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Did you consider, like, what is the role of those things? What do I do about this? How do I, you know? Or did you just sort of...
I mean, I was open-minded to it. I mean, if it was good and then I had found it on my own, you know, I wasn't going to turn it down. But, and in the process of organizing that show, I really kind of canvassed a lot of people and said, well, have you ever done anything about Kurt? Or do you know any artists that have done things about Kurt? And so I was really trying to kind of use that network as much as possible to sort of beat things out of the bushes. And a lot of stuff came that way. I mean, I definitely had a checklist in my head when I first started thinking about this, because I've just remembered all these different artists doing things about him in totally unrelated ways. And so that was at least a good starting point. So. Mm-hmm.
And the Warhol show, that come about, that's Marissa's show. Mm-hmm. Did that come about because of the gift of some of the...
No, we didn't get that gift. That gift of Polaroids only went to university art galleries. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that came about also, you know, really as an effort to extend the audience for Kurt, really, and to think that, well, there's going to be some generational limitations to this Kurt show. How do we make this bigger, more relevant, broader, and, you know, not exclude all these summertime visitors, you know, that are going to come here. And then, you know, we thought about Andy Warhol as somebody that embodied a lot of these same issues that Kurt Cobain did. And in many, I mean, it's too bad that I don't think anybody ever got Kurt Cobain on record talking about Andy Warhol, but there's a lot of things that look like Kurt's taken them right out of Andy's playbook in terms of how he dealt with the media and, you know, things like that, and kind of being mysterious, making up stories, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Playing to the camera in different ways, or to the fans, you know, like showing up on a wheelchair on stage, and, you know, that kind of stuff. There's the very Warholian tricks that he was playing at that time. So, so we just, you know, thought that those two would go together, and then so Marissa just really ran with that idea and you know, pulled together that show, and was, you know, really looking for, you know, works that dealt with these kind of tragic ideas.
And most of that work comes from where?
Most of it comes from the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh and the Warhol Foundation in New York.
One of the other things that I wanted to ask you about, and someone suggested I ask you about, so let's pepper this conversation with questions from other people too, but who are some artists, young artists in Seattle, who aren't quite ready for museum attention, but who you would have kept an eye on had you stayed here, and maybe will still keep an eye on.
I think Matthew Offenbacher has been a just incredible, kind of an energizer bunny of change and dialogue and discourse in this town. You know, really kind of bringing a lot of artists together to talk about things in serious ways. He's out there doing studio visits, and they're coming to his studio. And so he really got a lot going. And I think that his paintings themselves are really interesting, and he's really developing at a pretty fast pace. And so I'm very curious to see what he does next. And I think he really cares about this community too. And I think he sees this potential in this place, and, you know, is trying to kind of, I mean, oftentimes it really takes this super grassroots effort like that to change a place and to raise the level of dialogue. And so I really think he's doing that. I mean, it's no secret that I think Eli Hansen is really fantastic. And again, tapping it to something very local in his work and communicating it in a complicated way. And also the way that he's sort of attacking the glass world head on, or the glass tradition. And I don't just mean attacking in kind of a negative way, but just wrestling with that and trying to understand it and trying to capture, you know, channel his skills to do something different there, I think is super meaningful, because that's, you know, an 800-pound gorilla in the Northwest art world is the studio glass movement. And, so it'd be, I mean, there's definitely room for people like him. I mean, Josiah McElhaney was you know, doing it too, but he doesn't live here anymore. So, you know, I think they're
doing it very differently.
Yeah. My goodness. But there's definitely more room for more of that kind of more self-critical use of glass, I think, in Seattle. I think that would be fun to see that. And maybe now that the UW's got a glass program, maybe that will happen. But I'm not really sure. I actually don't know much about the professor that's teaching, that they brought in to teach glass there.
Any other artists, younger artists?
I'm trying to think of who out there. I have high hopes for Ann Mathern. She if she's listening, she'll know that I've kind of been a little tough on her, and I've really tried to challenge her a little bit, and because I think she's got, you know, the attitude and the ambition, and just sort of needs to just be, you know, to channel that in a more disciplined way. And she just came back from LA doing this mountain school down there, and it sounds like that was a really productive sojourn for her. And I mean, oftentimes I think it takes a little change of place to change your perspective. I mean, somebody leaving like Vic Haven would say how important that was, or Gretchen Bennett kind of leaving and then coming back. And I think you do see that kind of more and more. The people that are really kind of pushing things have stepped outside, and then they can come back in and understand what's special about Seattle and kind of channel that in a more clear-eyed way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the duo of Saul Hashimi and Jason Harada, I mean, I just like the pluck of those guys. They're out there doing it, and you kind of just have to. You have to just create your own scene and kind of make stuff happen and take any little opportunity you get. And so that's, I think that's really important to do. I don't think there's anybody. Well, you know, another person that I think is super promising is Nicholas Nyland. And I love how he seems to be pushing, you know, working with ceramics, working with drawings, working with paper mache, doing paintings. I mean, I think there's really something going on there that I'd love to keep track of.
Yep.
So, and you know, Jenny Heishman too seems to really be pushing herself.
And she's got a new installation at the Sculpture Park.
Yeah.
Opening this weekend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I pushed you not to put you on the spot, but because I know it's really meaningful for audiences and artists to hear that, those kind of things. So thanks.
And the thing about, I mean, all of those people is that they're not just sort of sitting back, you know, on their laurels or doing their kind of comfortable thing. They're really pushing themselves and going into uncomfortable territory, and they don't know where it's coming. I mean, another good example, he's not in that same category, is Joe Park. I mean, he has, I think, taken more risks than anybody else here in Seattle that I know, in a way, and going into territory that can be really kitschy or really problematic. I mean, I know all of his friends heard on his case about doing these portraits and stuff, but he, I mean, in the 4 years I've been here, he's made it just a gigantic transformation in his work.
From what to what? How would you describe it?
Well, I mean, when I first got here, he was just sort of at the tail end of doing this little bit more monochromatic, cartoonish things that deal with sort of Asian identity and things like that, you know, the kind of elephants and animals,
and
young kind of cartoonish cowboys and stuff like that. And I think he maybe, I don't know if he was actually dissatisfied with that but somehow he really upped the level of the virtuosity in his work, which I think the portraits did. Taught himself new techniques, and now with this, I'm trying to think of what the he's got a term for his new movement, prismism,
yeah.
Which I think is really clever, because it's obviously tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
But it's got a kind of corniness to it, but also, you know, I think he's thought of it as a kind of a made up art movement, which in itself is this narrative fabrication that I think feels totally contemporary to me. And he's going with it, and he's devised this visual style that matches it. And, you know, the way that these thrift store paintings become prismized, you know, is just really smart. So he's got to a point where the content and the form are really working together in a very interesting way. And these things are just spectacular to behold. I mean, the craft of them is amazing. and they're visually exciting to look at, and then there's a backstory to them. So, you know, he's starting to really kind of pull all these things together.
There's one you see right when you come into the office.
Yeah,
right?
It's a portrait of Susan Brotman. Yeah. Yeah,
she gets good portraits. She has another one. Isn't there one?
Francesco Clemente did one of her that's in their home.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't think of any other ones, but that's my take-home message to artists. Like, try, take risks, get out there, do stuff, because, I mean, especially in Seattle where it's harder to make inroads in the broader art world, you've got to really distinguish yourself with risky stuff. And I do think people are looking for work that has a regional inflection, that's not just part of some general homogenous international language of art, but that,
sure,
you know, is digging into moss and trees and meth culture or whatever, you know, like whatever stuff is going on here that's unique and unusual and feels like frontier. I don't think they should shy away from the frontiersy aspect of Seattle. I mean, I think that's one of the things that fuels Whiting Tennis's work.
Oh yeah.
And makes it unusual and makes a curator from or a dealer from somewhere else want to put that work in an exhibition, you know, because it's fresh and different and doesn't just look like slick New York stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, the quick question about publishing. There's a book, beautiful book for Target Practice, not for Kurt.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? Money?
Money, yeah.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Neither show traveling. Both shows won venues. Why?
We really did try to travel the Target Practice show, and it was the timing, economically was not great for the rest of the world. It was a time when a lot of museums were kind of pulling back and not taking shows, doing collection shows, things like that. But then also historically, group shows are really notoriously hard to travel. You really find monographic shows more often being the ones that kind of get out there and circulate around. And I mean, I think part of the reason for that is a monographic show is about an artist, and there's only so much that a curator can do to kind of claim that artist or steer that dialogue. But a group show is really about one curator's idea and forming an argument. So you can kind of understand why maybe other museums wouldn't want to use another curator's argument to. So it's just fairly rare that you find group shows out there traveling, which, you know, it was definitely...
classic case of a traveling group show blockbuster, Superflat, your show from MoCA.
Yeah.
So it can be done, certainly, but it's...
And it tends to maybe be done on a topic like that where it's almost like news from abroad or, you know, the Chinese art show or this, you know, something that's maybe a snapshot of a certain country or something like that, where this was, a broader type of show. And in fact, we did get some feedback from museums that I thought maybe would be sympathetic to the show, that at places like the Walker or even MoMA, where they could do this show from their own collection because they have these sorts of works in their collection. But of course, so that's another thing, like you're bringing in this outside curator to do the show that should have been done at your place with your own collection. And so, you know, you can see where it becomes an issue.
Yeah.
I mean, so it was a disappointment in a way, but I also kind of like the cult factor that this was just in Seattle, you know, and that the book's out there. Like, oh darn, I wish I had seen that show. And so I was really pleased with the buzz that it got and the word of mouth, and that the book is so beautiful that Derek Barnett designed for us, and that it's sort of out there in the world. So,
You just mentioned the name Derek, so I'm just gonna run with it. Derek Cartwright, new director here. You worked under Mimi for a while, and now you've been working under Derek.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe him? How would you describe the difference? What's the, or if you don't want to, you know, I don't know how you want to do that, but you've worked for several directors and certainly know a lot of directors. So how would you describe this one?
Well, it's funny how circumstances change so much. I mean, when I came in and was working with Mimi, you know, this museum was just go, 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 you know, Sculpture Park, new expansion. I mean, the sky's the limit. The economy was chugging along. Everything was great. So there was this...
2006, this was...
Yeah, there was this ambition there that was just palpable. And like, yeah, I want to join that team and do that, you know. And so it was really exciting. And you know, I think unfortunately, when Derek, you know, got here, the economy was already starting to ratchet back, and now it's ratcheted back further. And You know, so he hasn't been able to experience that those go-go, you know, times that, Mimi kind of really was able to ride, you know, right through to the end of her tenure. So, so unfortunately, I think he's, you know, having to deal with, you know, a different climate economically and having to kind of make tough decisions, you know, about reducing staff and things like that just to kind of weather the storm financially. So it's kind of hard to, or maybe even unfair to even compare the two just because of those circumstances alone. But I know that he...
Almost like running two different museums.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of is. It's I don't wouldn't go as so far as to say it's a different place, but you know, there's just a, and it's not like we were being extravagant in the past, but it just seemed like, you know, there was so much going on and we're riding such a high that it's, you know, it's a little bit more sobering now.
Well, but I wanted to ask that, you know, that this came up in, there was, I think 2 weeks ago, there's some cuts, and I had spoken to someone who mentioned to me after I'd written about these cuts that actually Mimi had made cuts pretty much the same size, but hadn't really talked about them. So there's a difference of transparency, which, you know, from my perspective is obvious. But also, you know, this kind of guts falling out of the business plan in a certain way because of WAMU collapsing, and nobody could have seen that coming, obviously. And I wrote a little something recently, just sort of, I started to get questions from people like, is Sam on fire? Are they falling down? Are they terrible? Is it, you know, and Derek had said to me that some of the donors were saying, well, we're not going to give you money until we're sure it's not going down a hole, and blah, 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 you know, this sort of thing. And what I'd written is like, hey, whoa, like, did anyone notice that WAMU shut down? You know, like, that is the biggest hit. It's a huge hit. It's $5.8 million a year that now is maybe going to be filled 75% by Nordstrom, probably at very much lower rates, hasn't even been filled yet. And we're still only talking about a $2 million cut, half of which was taken by the board this time. So you're talking about a $1 million internal cut, which if WAMU hadn't happened, you wouldn't be looking at it at all. Granted, WAMU's happened. So I guess the question that I have for you, and you're not a finance specialist, absolutely, so that's not your area, but in curatorial, one of the things I noticed with the expansion, I mean, I guess everybody probably knows, is that suddenly there were three venues instead of just two. Curatorial staff, same size. Is this doable?
Yeah, I think it is doable.
I mean I've complained about the quiet of the sculpture park. I mean, I'm really excited about this summer, but 3.5 years is a long time to wait for a really serious summer program or, you know, ephemeral program.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question that I've worked harder in my 4 years here than I've ever worked in my life. we don't have any administrative assistants or anybody, you know, to kind of, where oftentimes, you know, things like loan forms that are more time consuming, or, you know, even labels or, you know, acquisition paperwork. I mean, we have to do everything from the tiniest detail to the like biggest grand plan scheme. So it's intense. It's definitely intense. And
I heard in the recent round of layoffs, Derek laid off his own assistant.
I know.
So he's doing his own.
Yeah. I can't even imagine. I really can't even imagine how he can function without an assistant. I do think it's doable. I think it's a demanding job, but the rewards are there. I mean, the kind of feedback that we've gotten during this 4 years, you know, from the community in particular, has been so gratifying, and I think stuff has happened, and you know, so it's been exciting. We're not doing it in a vacuum. We're not just doing stuff and then nobody's paying attention, nobody's listening. I mean, it really feels like it's making a difference. So that's been really encouraging about it.
Is there anything you would say to donors? I mean, you've given some advice to artists, but what would you say to donors? Both donors of art and donors of money.
I mean, I still think that a super healthy art museum is absolutely crucial to attracting jobs to the city and things like that. So, you know, I mean, the donors are doing a lot, but the city and the government, you know, aren't really doing that much. And so I know that we've been doing a lot of lobbying on that front to try to to direct more tax dollars and things like that to the arts, because, you know, some sort of hotshot person that's coming to Microsoft is going to look at Seattle and like, well, what kind of, do they have a good museum? Do they have a good opera? Do they have, you know, they're looking at all those things to have a balanced, rich life. So it really has big effects on what the future of the city is, you know. So Which is, it makes, it's a much easier argument to make than art is good for you, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a good one, I think, to kind of go after. But I mean, I think it is worth keeping in mind that even though the sculpture park is fantastic and it is free though, and so it's harder to make a case to invest money to do spectacular things over there when, you know, you're not getting any kind of gate.
Make a case to whom?
Well, to the museum itself, when, you know, we're putting on a big, spectacular, very expensive Picasso show,
right,
which we expect will also bring a big visitorship, which will also bring money to the museum to keep it afloat. You know, in a way, big, expensive gestures at the sculpture park are totally free.
Right. They're not directly monetizable, but it seems that they're a fantastic form of PR.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think of a better.
It's true, and I think when the museum is back at full financial health, that would be something that would be easier too.
Has anyone ever floated the idea of a sculpture curator here?
No.
No. What do you think?
You know what? We need more than a sculpture curator. We need more conservators, actually, because
really?
Our conservation mm-hmm. team is absolutely stretched thin, mm-hmm. trying to keep up with keeping those pieces sort of up to snuff, and then everything else in the museum. So that's that. I think the curator here, the contemporary curator, can keep on top of the sculpture park, because it happens more slowly anyway. I mean, the process of putting something in there is a long process. It involves all these engineers and, you know, trucks and cranes and all those kinds of things. So it's a big endeavor, and I don't think anybody ever expected us to kind of plop in a new piece every single year, because pretty soon it's going to fill up. So I think, you know, a slow-ish measured approach does make sense over there. But I think there are opportunities to do things that are more temporary. I mean, this one that we're doing this summer is a good example of that. I think something maybe with artists, I mean, one thing that I've talked about a lot is trying to do a single artist show that maybe is up for a year there, where you bring in an artist of fairly high stature, maybe install five pieces by that artist and have a solo show in the park.
Louise Bourgeois.
You know, that would be great.
Go.
Yeah. Right? So, I mean, there are possibilities like that, but it's just,
sure.
you know, when resources are scarce, you know, I think,
sure.
you know, we're trying to just maintain over there and keep it looking good. But, you know, I mean, I think they want to make it stimulating though.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's going to happen. Most of the art that's in the park anyway has been donated to us. So I think that's where new art opportunities are going to come from, donations of sculptures in the future too. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. What about, I think we've talked about this in the past, but in your 10-year acquisitions budget, what is it?
Well, it's pretty fluid. There's sort of a number that all of the departments kind of share as for general acquisition money, and it's a pretty small number.
Isn't that the 300,000
number?
Yeah,
it's about that.
Okay.
Some departments have additional monies on top of that, some don't. And so the one thing that I've been able to do since I've been here is started at Contemporary Collectors Group, where the goal is really kind of educating people to learn more about contemporary art, to demystify it in a way, to get them out there buying stuff, looking at stuff. And as part of that process and the meetings that we have, they pay annual dues, and those dues go towards acquisition. So we've been able to generate, you know, another six figures worth of dollars every year to go out and buy contemporary artworks for the museum.
When
so
did you start that?
That started in, I think it started in... in 2008, the
okay.
very beginning of 2008.
About how many people are on that?
About 30 households, I think.
Wow, okay. How often do they meet?
For sure quarterly, you know, with meetings where we have an agenda and look at artworks that we want to purchase or that maybe are being given to us, but then usually at least another meeting in between all of those, where sometimes we'll go, you know, on a trip or go visit a collection, or, you know, maybe an artist is coming to town and do a party of some kind, so that, you know, try to have supplemental activities mm-hmm. kind of in and amongst mm-hmm. those core activities. So that was a brand new initiative that we were able to start here in the contemporary art department.
And we've talked a little bit about the park. What about the building? This new building has opened since you've been here.
Mm-hmm.
I have complained about certain things, such as the small space for photography,
mm-hmm.
and the very small space for the Betty Bowen Award.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to ask, what are your ideas about how the building works, how it could be used differently? I mean, we've seen it in this iteration, and you know, the tendency to see something that's normal as almost natural, or to see something that is as normal and natural, you know. Mm-hmm. And obviously it could change, it could go in any which way. Mm-hmm. What do you think about, for instance, the special exhibitions being in the Venturi spaces, where and the permanent stuff being in the Clofield spaces? I mean, how do you feel about the breakdown of the space?
I feel like I could use, you know, another one or two more galleries probably for in contemporary to deal. Like, so I also think that the photography situation is not ideal. That feels, you know, it's a hallway essentially, not, you know, a proper gallery in our collection. I think merits sort of a better kind of display, but the trade-offs are kind of difficult. I don't know what else I would give up to do that. I mean, I really like the fact that we've got an AVEX room and a minimalism room, because I think we have strengths in both of those areas. And you know, I've tried to do more pop art in that outside space at the top of the escalator, mm-hmm. but that's probably the most problematic space for me right now. That also feels
space.
Too much like a pass-through,
mm-hmm.
and is not squared off enough to contain the energy in there. And oftentimes you're kind of looking at things in the sidelong way, and rather than confronting them directly. So I think there's some, we've talked about some tweaks in there that maybe could be made to correct that a little
Such
bit more.
Such as?
Well, I mean, a perpendicular wall.
I was going to ask,
of
yeah.
some kind,
okay.
or in some
break
location.
It, break
that,
the space.
Yeah, to break mm-hmm. the space. And to maybe kind of interrupt the flow a little bit. To,
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, people kind of get off the escalator up there, and they oftentimes don't know where to go exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And
a lot of options.
Yeah, so to try to maybe eliminate the mm-hmm. paradox of choice there a little bit.
Do you like having Special X in Venturi? That's
yeah,
a different style space.
I don't mind it. Mm-hmm. I don't mind it. I think it's fairly flexible. I mean, you got some of those Venturi quirks, but from a practical standpoint, having a space that you can kind of annex off while you're reinstalling it, you know, is nicer than having it in a space where there's all this circulation around it and people are encountering dead galleries. It's better to kind of have it up there where it's at the end of a circuit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're, you know, learning to use that space in different ways. And I think the fact that you can divide it like we've done with Kurt and Andy is actually a good thing. And having multiple, or with Calder and Michelangelo, I think, because those spaces are fairly distinct in feeling from one another. And I think, you know, to diversify the audience and the offerings is a good idea to have that happen, or be able to use all of it at the same time if you wanted to, like we will with Picasso. So
I've talked a little bit about free admission or suggested admission being a really great thing here.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take?
Well, I mean, you pointed out nicely that it's a suggested admission, so essentially it is free already if people know to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the business model here does depend a lot on admission and gate for revenue.
Really? More than other museums? Because at other museums,
not necessarily more than other museums,
poultry.
But
usually it's under 5% of the revenues.
No, I think it's often quite a bit higher than that.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Especially at general museums, I think.
Hmm.
And like, for instance, at MoCA, when I was there, they always had it. I don't know what the percentage is, but it was always a fairly low percentage. They always, you know, kind of
yeah.
kept it modest
yeah, yeah.
in order, and knew that they had to raise their money in other ways. And so, you know, I think the numbers are a little bit high here in terms
for general interest.
Yeah,
do you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, not. I mean, I think they're high in general. I think it's when you see a downturn that, you know, it becomes a problem, and it does oftentimes force you to do shows that are more popular, you know,
mm-hmm.
in order to make that gate back. I mean, I bet if you, I think it would be a fairly easy statistic to kind of find
yep.
other museums. But
and you would think looking at general museums would be the most.
I think that's the most comparable to us, you know,
yeah.
to look at other
yeah.
general museums.
Yeah.
But as soon as you start, if that number
Black
starts
Mo,
getting too
instance.
High,
mm-hmm.
you start doing King Tut shows, you
right.
know, because
right.
you have to make up that
mm-hmm.
difference. And if you have other revenue sources, you can kind of bring that number down. And again, we don't have any kind of good city or governmental support here that would allow us to bring that number down, especially if we think that we've kind of maxed out corporations and individuals and foundations to a certain point. That would be the natural place where a knight in shining armor could come in and take some of that pressure off.
Right. But you do feel like it's a little bit on the high end.
I think it might be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I have not felt that the curators have been pressured into doing shows that compromised integrity in any way in order to sort of make it more palatable and more mm-hmm. populist. I think we've, you know, even with a show like Hopper or Wyeth, you've got name recognition, but also really good art to back it up. And those kinds of, I think there are shows like that out there, or artists like that out there that have appeal, but also have real integrity, and in that you don't have to necessarily do Shepherd Fairey shows, or, you know, Dennis Hopper shows, or something to make that work.
Do you feel like Sam has done a good job on virtually on the web, on Facebook, on Twitter, on iPhones, on apps, on whatever, you know, that kind of?
I am a bit of a Luddite myself, and I don't use those things, so I don't even know how well we do with those things.
Okay.
I know we have a really creative team that's very dedicated to that stuff and is really kind of keeping up with the latest developments and is trying to kind of push more content in that way. I have been impressed with, you know, certain kind of web projects that we've done for marketing purposes, like with Target Practice or other things. They've come up with really creative things that they've done on the web that mm-hmm. entice people more and maybe want to get them to see the show and even teach them to a certain extent. But I also think that our current design regime has done a really good job of kind of upping the sophistication of our visual materials out there. Mm-hmm. There's a man named Matthew Renton that joined us about a year or a half ago or something, mm-hmm. and he's really revamped and revolutionized that whole department and really got people thinking in very fun, dynamic, creative ways. And so that I think that's been really important.
It seems to me one of the powers of the web is that it helps institutions reduce the appearance of institutionality. Mm-hmm. You know, so mm-hmm. there are those ways that you can kind of, you know, work ideas into the flow that wouldn't find a place if they needed space on the wall or mm-hmm. if they needed an entire program, or if they, you know, that would have to require committees and, you know, all that mm-hmm. sort of stuff. So,
yeah, I think we're at an interesting kind of tipping point, because on the one hand, the museum's traditionally been a place where you go for expertise and you go mm-hmm. to be kind of told what is important or what is good in the culture, and yet we're moving toward these kind of forms of media where the user wants to kind of make those decisions or comment on that, and so I think that's where there's maybe some kind of growing pains still, you know, to kind of for curators in particular to kind of give up a level of control or expertise, or at least open it up to more interpretation by the public, and I think there are definitely ways to do that where you can have both. You can kind of have the official voice of the museum and also sort of have a platform for the general public to own that museum or show its ownership in interesting, you know, productive ways.
Yeah,
so.
It's hard to do. It's hard balance. Mm-hmm. We struggle with it in newspapers too. Mm-hmm. So,
when your comments on your blog start to take over your own blog content,
you sort of feel like you have to be a magical person. Like, I think certain personalities are really great at it. You know, mm-hmm. Max Anderson is somebody who obviously is really good at. He can express an opinion that really seems to be his opinion, but it also sort of works as the Indianapolis Museum's opinion, and it also works as part of the national dialogue and the conversation with the AMD, and, you know, it's part of the way he carries it across. It's part of what he knows, his broad base of knowledge. It's part of his attitude and level of anxiety and confidence, you know. So it's all, I know. Before you leave, what's your favorite museum in the world?
Oh, wow. Need to go there, want to go there, learn something new every time. I guess I maybe would sort of say MoMA in a way, because of the kind of quality of things that are there. I do tend to kind of learn something new every time I go there. So, you know, it might be nice if things changed a bit more frequently. But I don't know. That would probably be kind of right up there, I would say, just because it's you know, big and it's hard to digest, and there's usually a lot going on there. And they've got some really dynamic curators there, especially now, that are kind of churning out more quirky, unusual, you know, shows and ideas and things like that. So it'd probably be something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thanks for your candidness here. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you very much for listening. This has been Invisible.